The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:35 in the afternoon of Friday, Leap Day, February 29th, 2008. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Huggins is here, Senator Terrio, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. We've got two items up on the calendar, but one bill I want to bring up before we get too far along, and that is SB 185 by Senator Wilkowski. We and Senator Wilkowski and Senator Ellis is a co-sponsor. We heard the bill at the last hearing, took public testimony, took some committee discussion. There is a question about the fiscal note, and we've gotten an updated note from public safety. There will be a forthcoming updated note from the Department of Law to reflect the change in the bill from a 5-day period to a 1-day update. And it's my understanding that this bill goes to Finance Committee, where that new updated fiscal note should meet it. Is there further committee discussion or debate about SB 185? Is there a motion? Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that this very good bill, SB 185, be moved from committee to the next committee of referral, along with attached fiscal notes and accompanying individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. Next up is SB 234, a governor's crime bill, and we have here to present the bill Mr. Rick Svobodny. Mr. Svobodny, welcome to the committee. Good to see you this afternoon. Please come up, put yourself on the record, and begin to give us a walkthrough of SB 234.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Svobodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I don't know exactly how you want me to proceed. It sounded there like you wanted me to just go through this section by section. I believe there are people online who may want to testify, or also some that are there just to answer questions.
We have one member of the public who wants to testify, so perhaps what we'll do is have you give us an overview of the bill, just a section by section description, take the public testimony, and then we'll go to committee discussion for individual questions about the sections.
Mr. Chairman, I kind of have a theme for this bill, and that is small changes make big differences. That's something you may have heard, because it was used quite a bit last month in the crime conference that you sponsored before this committee. This bill does not make any major changes in creating new crimes in this state. Lots of time, or it's not a redraft of the sentencing provisions or the provisions of our statute that deal with criminal procedure. But it does involve small changes in each of those areas that hopefully will have a big effect for victims of crime, for police officers trying to investigate crimes, and for prosecutors in the prosecution of those crimes. I kind of divide the bill into three themes: new crimes, criminal proceedings, and sentencing. There's some overlap in those areas, and I'll go over them with you. But in dealing with the area of new crimes, first, sections 1 and 2 deal with not really a new crime, but a new way of looking at assault in the fourth degree. As you all know, assault in the fourth degree is an A misdemeanor offense. The provisions of this bill would change a fourth degree assault offense if committed twice before in the preceding 10 years from an A misdemeanor to a C felony. One particular thing to look for in that change is it's not all fourth degree assaults. It is only those fourth degree assaults that are not, well, they're assaults where there's actually been physical contact between the offender and the victim. About half of the fourth degree assaults are what I refer to as fear assaults, placing a person in fear of imminent physical injury. It does not include those. So this includes the situation where a person has beat their spouse once, been convicted twice, been convicted, and then the third time, it would change from an A misdemeanor to a C felony. The
Mr.
next,
Bondi, we do have one question about that, and I have a question as well, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, maybe two questions here. I guess question one is, do we want to limit this only to fourth degree assaults? If someone is committing multiple first, second, third degree assaults, maybe we want, have you given thought to increasing those punishments? That's question number one. Question number two is, it says has been previously convicted. If someone pleads to the crime, is that considered a conviction?
Actually, there's another provision of the bill that that gets to that. It's we believe that what you've done in the past, it's been your intent that it's a point of sentencing that counts as the time of conviction. There's different ways of defining time of conviction. For some situations, it is the time that a person is found guilty. That is the return of a jury verdict or the change of plea. For others, it's the time the judgment's actually entered. But we've always believed that what you've meant in the past when you said that was the time of sentencing, and we should clarify that in this bill. You will see that as we go down here, we did clarify that for theft. So that was one of your questions. Oh, the other is, have we thought about doing this for other offenses? Actually, the predicate crimes for this, the two prior offenses, could be assault. Well, could be murder in the first or second degree, manslaughter, assault in the first or second degree. And that's why actually we put a 10-year look back period in this bill, because say you were convicted of criminally negligent homicide and received a 5-6 year sentence, you'd be halfway through that time period before you got out of jail. So we thought about it from that end. We didn't think about it from, well, we thought about it, but thought that it was better public policy to limit this to actual physical contact. We thought about the other crimes that are crimes against people, like stalking, like reckless endangerment, but decided to limit it to the offenses where there was actual physical force impacted on the body of another. So we did think about it, but thought that this was a better public policy.
I have a follow-up question on that point. Can fear assaults be a predicate prior?
Yes.
So it could be a fear assault, either an assault for fear assault or an assault three fear assault. Those could count as priors. But it has to be a pain assault in order for it to for a misdemeanor to become a felony.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. If I may,
please.
When you get too specific about it, that we potentially have the issues of Blakely and what should have been tried to a jury before, with leaving it. Any assault, previous assault, then we don't have to go back and figure out specifically what those elements were in the assault in the third degree, whether it was a fear assault or it was an actual physical injury assault.
One more question,
yeah.
Please.
For assaults that have occurred prior to the implementation of this law, is there an ex post facto issue? You commit two assaults, you've committed two assaults now before this law is enacted, the day the law goes in, you commit a third one. Are there ex post facto issues?
Senator, through the chair, no, there aren't. This issue has been litigated many times, dealing with like the third felony DWI being, the third DWI being a felony, the third theft being a felony. We aren't creating a new offense here. We're saying from this point forward, if you commit a third time assault, it would be a felony assault.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Section let me just jump forward to 12, 13, and 14. Those are really just conforming amendments to dealing with the assault and the degree provisions. Section 3, though, is presently, if you commit a third misdemeanor theft, it becomes a felony offense. And we believe you meant that you count that time from the time of sentencing. The Court of Appeals has reviewed the legislative history in regards to that and said that it is the time of sentencing. But for people reading the statutes, we thought it should be clarified and just put in the statute that for the third theft to count as a felony theft, what you mean is at the time of sentencing. So at the time you start receiving the benefit of the sentence, whether it be rehabilitative or protecting a society, is probably the best trigger point there.
Mr. Zabani, I'll just say it takes a true DA to say receive the benefit of a sentence, and I commend you for that. Point out that there is frequently a gap between the date of a guilty plea and the imposition of a sentence, and so it'd be during that time that you might pick up a third theft charge, but you wouldn't be charged with a felony under this statute because it's actually the day of the sentence.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Section 4 deals with actually the addition of a new provision to a present existing crime. Resisting arrest can be committed now in one of three ways: the use of force, any degree of criminal mischief, or creating a substantial risk of serious physical injury.
Senator Wilkowski.
I guess I want to follow a little bit up on the chair's question. If you have someone out there that is, I guess, a serial assaulter, but you don't catch and has assaulted, let's say, five or six people within a short period of time, when you finally catch him, he can't be or she can't be punished under this provision, correct? Because
through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, under Section 1 and 2, the assaults, no, we couldn't, or the theft either. We would have to have two prior convictions within the time period that the legislature has set.
I'm sure the committee will ponder that as we keep the bill under consideration. But we are on Section 4 in disobeying an order of a peace officer. Is that based on a statute from somewhere else? Is that do you know, or is that something that the police has requested the Department of Law? What's the genesis of this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was about to get to that. Typically, what happens, and I know Trooper Dials was planning on being here, and he can explain in more detail the danger that it causes police. But typically, what happened, or not typically, but sometimes what happens is that a person will, I want to use the words of the Court of Appeals because I thought they had a good phrase for it, a turn turtle. They'll lay down, put their hands under their body, and pretend like they're a turtle. That means when the police are trying to arrest them, they haven't committed this offense by engaging in that passive conduct. And that creates a danger to the police because they still have to deal with this person. They're going to have to physically pull their arms out from under them. They're going to have to carry them away. Both the municipality of Anchorage and the city and borough of Juneau have dealt with this by saying it also is resisting arrest if you refuse the order of the police officer to stand up, move along with me, and they, instead of having to drag the person down the street, Our Court of Appeals has said if, in fact, you are doing that type of conduct, needing to be, dragged through down the street, or being the police need to be pinching you to get a response so they can get their arm out from under you, and that is not the crime of resisting arrest. Police officers don't feel like that's the situation, that it's really an intent of this person to resist the arrest, and it escalates the danger to the police officer and to the person being arrested if the police have to use a little bit of force then to get the person to respond, and then it seems to escalate. And so um, the this is a request by the Alaska State Troopers to come into conformity with what the Anchorage Police Department and the Juneau Police Department have found necessary to do in the past. I think Fairbanks, I'm not sure about Fairbanks.
So there's a municipal ordinance on this in Anchorage, for example?
Anchorage and Juneau, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
Is it presumed that it is a lawful order by a police officer? In other words, let's say you have a group of people that are exercising their First Amendment rights by legally protesting, a police officer comes by, tells him to disperse. He's wrong in telling him that. When you're saying disobeying an order, does that mean just any order, carte blanche, or does that mean any legal constitutional order? You see what I'm saying?
I understand, Mr. Chair, through the chair, I understand what you're asking, and there actually the language lawful order, I think, would concern all law enforcement because they don't want to be second-guessed in whether or not this person was resisting arrest 6 months later when the court said, well, you didn't have probable cause to be arresting that person, and so even though you thought you did, you shouldn't have been doing that, so they didn't commit the crime of resisting arrest when they hit you or swung a baseball bat at you. I think the way we get to your concern or the issue that you raised here is you have to intend to resist arrest, and in doing that you obey the lawful order, or you disobey the order of the police officer. So it's you have to have a particular state of mind that what I am doing is to resist the arrest that either my friend is being arrested for or I'm being arrested for. So I don't think the situation that you describe really comes up. It's not an order it's not with the intent to resist arrest that a person may not obey an order to move along because they're exercising a free speech right.
Please proceed.
In section 5 of the bill, this, although it doesn't appear to really be that, what the effect is it adds Soma and Ambien to the schedule of controlled substances. That's the same as many other states and the federal government. And what that means is the police can be charging people under the DWI or the DUI statutes for driving under the influence of Ambien and Soma. And you may recall the situation in Washington, D.C., where Representative Kennedy was driving under the influence of Ambien, didn't realize he hit a car, or that's what he told the police, and was really under the influence of a controlled substance. But that made national news, but the Ambien and Soma is a particular problem in this state.
What are they used for? I recognize the name Ambien, but I don't know what Soma.
I don't know what Soma is used for either. Ambien is sleep medication.
There's some indication they're both sleeping pills, but we'll get a little more follow up.
It has been suggested that I want to make sure all these drug commercials run together in my mind. That Lunestra ought to also be added to the Schedule 4A controlled substance. That I know came from staff of the Judiciary Committee. I asked Ms. Carpinetti to check with our crime lab to see whether that is a problem in Alaska, and was told that it also is by many states a Schedule 4A controlled substance because it is seen a lot in people driving under the influence. It is not the degree of the problem that Ambien and Soma is, and I don't know whether that's just because one of the drugs has a better commercial going on than the others, but it is a problem.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
I had a constituent raise this issue to me several months ago about people driving on prescription drugs and or even illegal drugs, and I guess the question is, how do you prove it? It's got to be extremely difficult to prove these cases.
Through the chair, Senator, it's a very difficult problem. Oftentimes, We need to call a toxicologist to come and explain under these circumstances whether this was a therapeutic amount of drugs that they had in their system, what their reaction to that would be. We the state of Alaska, have a contract with the Washington State Crime Lab to provide just that type of expert testimony in these cases. I can tell you right now that we have 5 homicide cases that deal with drugs where we are going to have to be calling a toxicologist, because you know it's not like it's not like alcohol where we know pretty definitively at what rates your abilities are impaired, and so you oftentimes have to end up by calling a pathologist or a toxicologist to explain that to the jury. So it is a very we have frankly a good deal with Washington State Crime Lab, and we're not able to do the toxicology at our crime lab, and so we've been able to do it in misdemeanor offenses, but if it gets much more expensive, we may just be doing it in felony cases.
Paul, are you anticipating you pull someone over and you don't smell alcohol, maybe you give them a breathalyzer test and it comes up negative, are you anticipating taking blood or other types of samples from people to verify this?
Through the chair, we have specially trained police officers who look for other things things that would indicate impaired driving, and they look even harder when they get if they're using a PBT and get a result of 0.00 and there was erratic driving, they ask questions about what drugs you're using. I don't want to give away secrets, but I think this one's not a big surprise. If they suspect marijuana, they ask you to stick out your tongue, and lots of times green tongues give them a clue down that road. They can't simply go and take blood. They would need to develop sufficient evidence to get a search warrant for blood. So sometimes they do take blood, but it's only after establishing sufficient probable cause, and we can't do that like we can use a breath test instrument. We have to go get a court order to do that.
Please proceed.
Section 6 is a provision that deals with the application of search warrants. We've had this arise recently with several judges where we've asked for search warrants for subscriber information to like America Online or internet providers that are outside of the state of Alaska. Frankly, those companies that provide that type of information would prefer us to just send them a subpoena to produce those documents, but we don't have, it's not like a civil case where we have a pending case going on, nor is it our practice like in the federal government to issue grand jury subpoenas for any time you want to get a document. We go and get a search warrant. We go to the court and we say, here's our probable cause. So we have had several judges say, well, I can't issue a search warrant for America Online, which happens to have its business offices in Virginia, to produce documents for the state of Alaska. America Online doesn't care whether the issuing court for that process is in Alaska or in Guam, for that matter. They just want some type of documentation. So in dealing with sexual offenses against children, both online enticement and child pornography, kind of the recent trend with our courts is to say we aren't going to give you a search warrant to get that information. Likewise with white collar crime type cases, if you're looking for a Bank of America's records, and actually I was going to say California, but I think they're now in Delaware or someplace like that, their corporate headquarters. We have judges saying, I don't have jurisdiction to grant a search warrant for the production of documents from Delaware. The practical practical response is we really don't care whether, the practical issue is that Bank of America with a search warrant, will, whether it's issued in Alaska or Delaware, will give us those documents. Even if they don't, we have the opportunity then to go into a Delaware court and say, look, we have the search warrant warrant issued from a court in Alaska. We want you to give that court full faith and credit. The general rule, some of you may recall that several years ago, the legislature expanded the extraterritorial ability of our courts to grant search warrants on state ferries and on airplane on state airplanes where they're actually whether in international waters or in the waters of the state of Washington, as long as they were assets or property of the state of Alaska. And the case law, when we researched that, it was pretty clear to us that our courts, if they have statutory authority, can issue search warrants outside of the that can be executed outside of the state of Alaska. Whether a local jurisdiction would want to help us execute it or not, that would be their that's when we would have to make a decision if we go into another state court to say, give the Alaska courts full faith and credit and give us an order allowing the search warrant to be executed. Okay. A pretty technical issue, but one that deals a lot with child pornography, child enticement, and white-collar crime. Section 7 is also a search warrant issue. Presently, police officers can obtain search warrants by telephone if they're if they can show several things, that there's going to be a delay in the execution of the search warrant and that the evidence will be destroyed in the time that it would take a police officer to get from where they're using the telephone to get to where the court is. This recently came to my attention where the police were 8 hours upriver by boat on the Yukon at a marijuana grow operation. They used a satellite phone to call into the court, got the search warrant, and we lost because we weren't able to show that within the 8 hours to get downriver get the search warrant that the evidence wouldn't be destroyed in that period of time. Times have changed.
When you say lost, Mr. Zabani, you're saying that evidence was suppressed?
That's right.
Wow. Thank you.
I think that the court followed the statute. I mean, we didn't show that something was going to happen during that 8-hour boat trip downriver to get the search warrant.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just a comment. I mean, hey, I'm all for law enforcement providing them all the tools they need, but at the same time, I'm also for protecting individuals' rights, and I'm also for. I guess I have some concern over this provision. We're essentially giving carte blanche to you don't have to prove there is a delay. You don't have to prove there's a loss or destruction, and so that concerns me a little bit. I don't see why you couldn't get on the phone and make a 5-minute presentation to a judge and say, hey, there's a risk this is going to be lost, and here's why, and the judge makes his finding. And I we're taking away citizens' rights here, and that concerns me when we do that.
Through the chair, I agree that we shouldn't be taking. I mean, citizens' rights are created by the Constitution, and we shouldn't be limiting those. And others have been created by case law and laws that the legislature has enacted. But here, we're not asking for anything really other than modern day. How everybody does business, to be able to use the telephone to obtain a search warrant. That means that the police still have to gather all their evidence. They still have to make a presentation to the court and show to the court that they have probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime or that fruits of a crime are at a particular location. They have to describe with particularity where that location is and convince a judge that they have sufficient evidence to do that. It's just kind of the way, the technique of getting that information to the judge that would be changed here. Right now, I mean, if the question was a search warrant for my house, I was going to say, some place in this building, all you'd have to do is walk across the street, but let's say my house, which is farther, a couple blocks away from here. You know, it doesn't take very long to go to the court and get that, but if it took long or it didn't take long, they wouldn't have to show that it's likely that the fruits of the crime or the evidence of the crime is likely to be destroyed before they get the search warrant. That provision only applies for the telephonic search warrants that we obtain now.
Mr. Zabani, this won't undercut the essential gatekeeping function of a magistrate or a judge, will it? I mean, they're still going to have to make a finding that there's probable cause that a crime's been committed and evidence is being hidden in this or that location, either in person or by telephone or by facsimile. The evidence is still going to have to convince the judge, no matter how it comes across his transom or her transom.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. It doesn't change any of the constitutional requirements of making a showing to a neutral judge or magistrate that there's probable cause to believe that it's more likely than not that the fruits of this crime or evidence of a crime are at a particular location. None of that changes. It's just the mechanics of how you get that in front of the judge.
And Senator Wilkowski has a question. I'll just say by way of comment, it just seems to me that there will be instances where you will perhaps not have a search warrant issued because the facts laid out in the facts, if you will, aren't sufficient or can't be elucidated further through questioning by the judge, and so it may be the weakest form of an application for a search warrant. Nevertheless, it strikes me that from time to time it's just a tool in the toolbox, so to speak. Senator Wilkowski,
what was the purpose in putting in sections 1 and 2 in the first place? I mean, has there historically been abuses when that wasn't in there?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm guessing at this, okay? I'm guessing because I've gone back and I've read the case law before we drafted this in the bill. At the time that our present law was drafted, most states don't allow search warrants by telephone or facsimile. Most states don't. Most states require that the application for a search warrant be in writing. Many states, like Alaska, allow for live testimony or testimony, and the few cases that have looked, there are three cases that have looked at the provision that was passed by the legislature several years ago, and they've said, you know, we think that it's better to have the person in either upholding or overturning the search warrant. One judge on our Court of Appeals has said repeatedly, we think it's better to have the officer in front of us. Now, you know, I guess that makes sense, and I would buy into that if that officer is testifying, but the rules say that the officer could write it all down and hand it to the judge, and then the judge reads the affidavit and grants or doesn't grant the search warrant. It seems better to me. It seems you would have a better feel for the evidence if you actually had the person on the phone and could ask questions and get answers. You could hear how their voice is, whether, you know, that this has been a deliberative process or they're rushing to a judgment here. So, you know, that's just one out of three justices. But I think what I'm saying to you is I think that because there were so few states at the time that our present law was enacted, that the legislature was taking the very conservative approach, and I've given you the example of the one justice on our court to say that you know, that's kind of what, you know, it's kind of the Alito approach, you know, that you go back and look at how they did it at the time that the Constitution was enacted, and they didn't type out things on their typewriters on their computers then.
Senator Wilkowski.
But I guess you're saying most states don't allow search warrants by phone.
That's correct.
We do. I mean, the way the law is written, we still do allow search warrants by phone. And that's appropriate because of the size of our state and trouble it is to get into the courthouse or the magistrate's office. But I mean, all we're saying here is the delay might result in loss or destruction of evidence or might interfere with an ongoing investigation. I just get worried that, you know, individuals have privacy rights. And I personally, before I have a police officer coming into my house, I'd like them to at least show that they have, you know, a Fourth Amendment, they've gone through the Fourth Amendment procedures and that there's some kind of safeguards before we're going into people's homes and businesses. And the way it's written, I think, it seems pretty reasonable to me. I guess I don't understand what the difficulty is in picking up the phone and just telling a judge, hey, here's the problem. There might be a loss or destruction of property. This might interfere with an ongoing investigation. If they can't prove that, then they probably don't deserve to get a search warrant, it would seem to me.
Through the chair, they'd get the search warrant now if they took the boat 8 miles, 8 hours down the river and did it in person. I mean, we aren't changing any of those rules about when you can search somebody's house. It is not a requirement. If the officer goes across the street to the court building here and writes it out on a piece of paper, he doesn't have to say that it's likely that this evidence will be destroyed. That's not a requirement of the Fourth Amendment. It's only a requirement if he does it differently. He does it by calling the judge or the magistrate. That's the only time that requirement. That's not a constitutional requirement. That's a requirement that's written into the statute. There is nothing in this portion of this bill that would restrict anybody's Fourth Amendment right. Right that's created by the Fourth Amendment.
It's a good policy debate. I'm sure we'll have more of that as the bill is considered in depth by the committee. But if we can, I'd like to continue. Mr. Zabodny, please.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sections 8, 9, 10, 11, 19, and 20 all deal with the situation where a person has been found incompetent to stand trial. You may have read in the last several months about the young man in Anchorage who burned down a house. Was found incompetent to stand trial, was released after that finding and burned down another house. Presently in Ketchikan, there's a person who has been charged with another arson, committed four arsons, I think was caught on the fourth one, admitted the first three, denied the fourth one, even though literally he was caught red-handed. He was caught starting the fire. Was found not competent to stand trial. Was sent to API. API made a determination that the person was not competent to stand trial. Returned to Ketchikan and then burned down. Started another fire in Ketchikan. Same issue. Defense comes in and says this person is not competent to stand trial. This time API said, well, we think he is. In that case is pending trial in Ketchikan. So this is likewise a similar situation, not arson, assault the behavior in Bethel and within the last year. Person found not competent, comes back to the community, commits the same crime again. The provisions of this bill do several things. First, before release back to the community, there's supposed to be notice given to the district attorney that the release will be occurring within 10 days. If a person is found incompetent to stand trial, they're found incompetent to stand trial, there is a requirement that there be an evaluation done for a determination of whether the person should be committed and treated at API. It creates a rebuttable presumption that if you're found incompetent, that is, if if you're represented by counsel, they've come in and proved to the court that you're not competent to stand trial, there's a rebuttable presumption then that you are mentally ill and a danger to yourself or the community. That's the standard for a determination of whether the person should be committed.
Mr. Zabani, I have a foundational question. I never worked in this area much, and so my question is what's the difference sort of legally between a finding that you're incompetent to stand trial and a verdict of not guilty by reasons of insanity?
Oh. that's not an area, Mr. Chairman, that I think I can do off the top of
head. We can say this for a future discussion, but that's just, I mean, you can see the parallel. I mean, one, you're sort of pushed out of the system before you ever get started, and the other, you go all through the system and you're pushed out at the end, both with the same sort of mental state.
I see. Maybe you're asking a simpler question than I thought. If you're found guilty but mentally ill,
GBMI.
You go to API.
Right. Where, if you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, you go home.
You walk. Right.
You don't go to API. You don't go get treatment.
That's correct.
So it's sort of the same, right? Right now, if you're incompetent to stand trial, you go home. If you're not guilty by reason of insanity, you go home.
I believe, and maybe we should hold this to a later discussion, but I believe that there are provisions of our present law that say that if you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, that there also has to be an evaluation. But I don't want to. I need to go look.
We'll do this is an overview of the bill, so we'll hold that for a future hearing. Thank you.
OPA and the public defender's offices have been concerned that this sweeps with too wide of a brush, and there's been Ms. Carpinetti and people from those offices have worked on a proposed amendment that in effect would limit the situations of what the court has to do to felony offenses as opposed to all offenses. Right now, they're concerned about the situation where somebody is charged with a minor offense like trespassing. They truly are incompetent to go to trial on that, but they don't want to be in a position where all those where that person then has to go through this process of treatment to become
civil
competent
commitment.
To and held at API and then have a rebuttable presumption that they're not that they're mentally ill and a danger to themselves, and that makes sense to me. On the other hand, I think that we need to be protecting the community from people who have convinced a court that something's going on in their mind, whether it's mental illness or some other reason, that they're not competent to meet the threshold of being able to communicate with their attorney and understand what's going on in a courtroom and have committed arson or murder or whatever serious crime. So I think that what's been worked out between the public defender and Ms. Carpinetti's probably a good approach.
We'll look forward to seeing that language.
Sections 11 and 18, I don't know whether Mr. Peterson, who was going to be present by phone, has joined us. If he has, maybe he'll correct me if I misstate this issue. But presently, we've seen courts who have said you cannot place somebody on probation for a violation. And typically the way that fish and game violations are dealt with is that an agreement is made that they're charged under Title 16 with a misdemeanor, and they agree to plead out to a violation and to pay a fine and not to violate the fish and game laws for two years. Well, the courts have said, well, we can't do that. I'm putting them on probation for 2 years. There and there's no provision for putting somebody on probation for a violation. sections 11 and 18 clarify that the court can put a person on probation, and specifically under section 18 makes that extends that to the fish and game cases.
Mr. Chairman, this is Andrew Peterson. I am online, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Peterson, thank you for that. I don't see any from the committee right now. Is there anything you wanted to add to Mr. Zavodny's statement?
Mr. Chairman, only that the addition of Section 18 also allows the state in a hunting case, when we reduce the charges from a misdemeanor to a violation. Oftentimes this happens in cases where someone self-reports. The fine structure in a violation for a hunting case is substantially lower than that in a commercial fishing case. In fact, it's limited to $500. One of the things that the troopers like to see is a small violation fine and then restitution for the animal, and the animal is oftentimes then donated to charity. Under current law, we can't ask for restitution for the animal, and the change in Section 18 would allow us to do that.
Thank you. Senator Huggins has a question.
Yes, sir. Quick question for you under, as I see it, moose is listed here as $1,000. And taking that one step further, in some game units we have the rule of 50 inches or X number of brow tines, which technically you could be convicted on and then pay $1,000 for the moose. My concern is, do we stop people from turning themselves in, which some people have done, some don't, and the cause and effect of that? Could you help me out very quickly?
Certainly. Senator Huggins to the chair. A number of factors go into play when we're making charging decisions in this kind of case. Whether somebody self-reports, if somebody else turns them in, that certainly makes a big difference whether we go between a misdemeanor to a violation. And in the case where somebody makes an honest mistake and they simply misjudge, they think it's a 50-inch bull, it's not, that's where we like to have the discretion to reduce this to a violation, a small fine. And we can also take into account how close it is to 50 inches, how the individual, you know, if they turn themselves in rather soon, that type of thing. The statute provides that the court may impose restitution. It's not a mandatory imposition. So then we can kind of talk with the troopers and gauge the appropriateness of our Rule 11 offer for each individual. Obviously, that's one of the things we take into concern. We don't want to encourage people to not self-report, and we try to consider that as a factor in every case that we work on.
Yeah. Senator Huggins, follow-up.
Yeah, just forget about what I said previously other than somebody was on the margin. But let's just take the moose as an example, maybe. 49 and a half inches. What is a small fine?
Well, right now on a violation, it would be, you know, probably $250, and that would be about half of what's allowed. We have had fines that have gone smaller. We've had fines that have gone higher. Generally, on a 49-and-a-half-inch moose, you don't see any fine. It's usually when it's a little greater of a disparity. One of the concerns that we have, Senator, and to the chair, is that if we decide not to impose any type of a violation fine on a 49-and-a-half-inch moose, then essentially that becomes a legal bull. We would obviously have to forfeit it. But there's no risk to the individual deciding that's close enough, I'll take the shot. And then that becomes a slippery slope. We've seen in some areas where it kind of became known that troopers wouldn't impose a fine for a 49-inch moose. They'd just forfeit it. And so people start taking risks that they probably shouldn't when they're in the field because they know there's no risk at all. Certainly in a case like this where we have an undersized animal and somebody self-reports, there is no forfeiture of their hunting license. There's nothing like that. So they're able to turn around and go out hunting the following year.
Okay, thank you very much.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're at section 15. Now we're getting to the sentencing provisions of this bill. Aggravated assaultive behavior is not defined by statute. The Court of Appeals has given us a definition that basically says if the assaultive behavior is a felony offense, meets the definition. This just clarifies in statute what the definition of aggravated assaultive behavior means. Section 16, we're still dealing with the aftermath of Blakely and trying to define in statute what the Supreme Court said in that case. In this instance, what needs to get tried to the jury is at issue. And this says that if there are repeated sexual assaults, that's not as an aggravating factor. That's not something that has to go to the jury to determine. It can be determined by the court if they're convictions. And that's pretty much the case law. If they're not convictions, they would have to go to the jury to decide. So we're just tightening up we're conforming the statutory language to the case law language.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Terrio.
Is there a particular case or a problem that you've run into with the prosecution there that highlighted that need to be clarified?
Senator Terrio through the chair. No, I mean, we've had that problem. Yes, that's, and we've gone to the Court of Appeals and they've given us that definition. But when you're sitting there in court trying to figure it out and you tend to look at the statutes, you don't have all those cases with you. And so we've had that problem in the past. We believe we know what the law is now. We just want to put it into statutory form. Section 17 is kind of goes back to the establishment of the United States Constitution. The only right given to the states in the Constitution is the right to demand extradition to the state where the crime occurred. This allows the governor to, so in this state, the governor signs all those warrants where Alabama is asking for the return of somebody from Alaska or, frankly, because that's in the Constitution, and I felt that there should be statutory authority for the governor to delegate signing those warrants to somebody else. Frankly, when I first started checking into this, I thought, maybe you couldn't do that, but I find that we're the only state where the governor actually signs those warrants. There's a delegation of this language that's in the bill comes from the Oregon statute that does that, but most other states just have it done by a machine. And there hasn't been a problem in any of those other states. It just is the conservative approach to put it in statute to allow the governor to do that. Talked about Section 21 repeals a bar to the state of that exists in the criminal prosecution in the state of Alaska. If there's a race to the courthouse between the federal government and the state of Alaska, and they get there first, they win. I mean, they get to, we can't prosecute a case. Or if another state does that. So in the situation where hypothetically there was a problem with what the oil companies were doing on a certain, and we were saying that there was a criminal law violation, we couldn't prosecute them for that criminal law violation if the U.S. government chose to charge them first. This kind of applies all throughout the criminal law. I mean, if it's a drug offense, we're barred from prosecution. If it's a pollution case, if it's theft by intentionally miscalculating how much money is going through a gas pipeline. Basically, we're barred from a prosecution if the federal government gets there first, and this eliminates those bars to criminal prosecution.
Senator Huggins has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Abadie, forget about petroleum business. How do you get out of double jeopardy?
We're separate sovereigns. We're the state of Alaska is its own sovereign, and that is the law. You know, that's been the law since the founding of the Federation of States. That, you know, that we can charge somebody with a crime. The state of Alaska, the state of California can charge somebody with a crime, or the U.S. government could charge somebody with a criminal offense. And as long as there's the elements of the crime and a territorial connection, there is no double jeopardy issue there. We have chosen, the state of Alaska, have chosen to impose that on ourselves by statute. For example, I felt, for example, a lot of pressure by people saying a year ago, well, why aren't you prosecuting this person for some political corruption or that person for some political particular instance of corruption? And my answer was, I can't. The law prohibits me from doing this. The federal government's beat us to the courthouse door. In the recent case of the pipeline corrosion, where the state of Alaska received a $4 million restitution from BP, we couldn't have gone. We were part of that case, and were able to negotiate what wasn't a separate conviction in that case for BP, because we were precluded from it because the feds were there and beat us to the door. That was an okay example because we worked out what a penalty for them anyhow. But if the federal government, I mean, there were times in those negotiations where we wanted a bigger penalty, and the federal government was saying to me, no, you know, we want this to be, you know, twice or three times the amount, and if you don't like it, you're tough luck, because we beat you there, and you're just going on our coattails.
Yeah, at the risk of somebody capturing in their mind that I'm supporting not, you know, going after people in corrosion, I'll factor out. This has been on our books for some period of time, evidently. There was some rationale for why it is. And, you know, do I think we should be able to recover corrosion business? The answer to that is yes. But there was some rationale of why it remained in place for such a long period of time. And I guess I would ask you what that is. I have no idea.
Well, through the chair, I think for the reason that you mentioned earlier, I think that kind of the visceral reaction of people is this is double jeopardy, that you shouldn't be penalized twice for the same conduct, even though the interests of the victims may well be different. The interest of the state of Alaska may be substantially different than the interest of the federal government. Even in drug cases, I mean, if you have a small amount of sale of cocaine, that we can't do a forfeiture of a lot of assets under our statute, the federal government can see that they can bring in $1 million in forfeiture of assets. They want that $1 million. We want the drug dealer off the street. So there are competing interests once you're getting down to the street crime.
Yeah. What other sort of things, minus drugs, would would my neighbors be subjected to work for petroleum companies and any of that sort of thing? You just ordinary people that they could expect this to be brought upon them?
I think primarily, if I may, Mr. Chairman, drug cases and child pornography type cases. It, in the last 5 to 7 years, there seems to be this trend with the federal government going in those type of cases and cherry picking, if you will, the better cases and then just leaving the more difficult, frankly, cases to the state. And I think when I say in those areas, drugs and child pornography seem to be that the area where that happens most often. But I would hope neither of those type of crimes would have your neighbors involved.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
But I think that would be the main area.
Senator Wilikowski.
Are we currently in line with other states? Does this put us in line with other states if we pass this provision?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I don't have a tally. I can get you one. I mean, it certainly is a one-way street when it's the state versus the federal government. The federal government always is maintained that it can, if the state charges somebody first, they can come back and charge somebody later on. So and they're the big dog in those fights. I can try to get you a breakdown of the states which have the bar and which don't.
I'm thinking of the Rodney King trial, which is probably the example that the public's most aware of, where a state prosecution failed, the feds prosecuted second, and so that's just an example where the feds have always retained the right to follow upon the state. I actually didn't realize there was a bar to a, that we were barred if they went first. But I'll be interested in learning more about this. No other questions at this time. Please proceed. Oh, sorry, Senator Wilikowski.
So 1171, 310, and 1220, 010 apply to double jeopardy, but 1235, 015F is about evidence suppression.
Yes, that's what? That's right.
Did I miss that part?
No, I hadn't done that one.
Oh, okay, I'm
that,
sorry.
That's the last one. Well, the second to the last one. Actually, section 21, just as a conforming to the other provision that I talked to you about earlier, about allowing telephone search warrants. So, but 22 is also a search warrant section, and that.
Well, let's just for the record, your sectional is a little bit confusing because there's two references to section 21. Section 21 has three statutes in it. You discussed the first two as pertaining to double jeopardy. The third statute reference is a cleanup relating back to Section 7, and that's allowing courts to issue search warrants by telephone or other electronic means.
I'm sorry.
See, that's how you got a
different one. That is Section 21. So.
Well, yeah. Like I say, in your sectional that I think we're both reading from, you've got two Section 21s. And so it just throws you off.
Oh, I see. Yes. I'm sorry. I don't know.
See what happened?
Yeah, I do.
You're clear, Senator Wilikowski?
Okay. I guess I just want to know why we're repealing AS 1235015F, which is about suppressing evidence obtained in bad faith.
That's the provisions that deal that Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that you pointed out. I think it was you, maybe it was Senator French, were looking at about the, it's repealing the section that says that you have to prove that the evidence may be destroyed in the application for the search warrant.
Can I follow up? I never did much criminal law, but here's what it says. It says 1235.0152 says the delay might result in loss or destruction of the evidence subject to seizure or might interfere with an ongoing investigation. And then there's a series of exceptions, I guess, and then there's that applies to Section A. Here's what Section F says. Absent a finding of bad faith, evidence obtained under a warrant issued under this section is not subject to a motion to suppress on the ground that the circumstances did not support its issuance under A of this section.
No. That provision is just no longer, would be no longer needed because we wouldn't be, it would be subject to the same rules of determining whether a search warrant was issued validly as all the rules are now. This is saying when you are making the specific application that you can't, that it's not an, not the right word, excuse, that provision gives the state an extra break if we haven't met the requirements of A. And it's not going to really be necessary if you just say that police officers can get search warrants by telephone.
If we could, well, we can postpone a more in-depth discussion of this. I've got a witness on the next bill I want to hear from who's about to go into a 20-day trial. We've got someone from the public who wants to testify, who's here in June and wants to testify on this bill. So maybe you can just give us a quick description of Section 22, and I think that gets us to the end.
22, rules of court require that there be a return of the search warrant within 10 days. Lots of times, in especially white collar crime cases, drug cases, even sexual abuse cases, you've captured a telephonic recording of somebody. You don't have your case finished up yet, so you want a longer period before you have to tell the person the search warrant was issued. We've captured your voice confessing to this case, or you know, doing this or doing that.
Mr. Zabotny, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll have you back when we have the bill back. I've got two folks who want to testify on the bill. One is here in the room, Mr. Whitaker, one of my constituents. If you'd like to come forward, Mr. Whitaker, put yourself on the record. Be happy to hear your comments. We've also got someone waiting online, Ron Adler. Mr. Adler, you'll be up next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Jed Whitaker. I wish to speak against Section 4 amended language disobeying an order of a police officer as being constituted a misdemeanor of resisting arrest. There's an old saying that the United States Constitution is only as good as the corner policeman. Over the last 20 years, police have become militarized, and prison populations have doubled. In fact, today's newspaper talks about a study that reports that 1 in 99 Americans are in jail or in prison. There are many reasons for this increase, but one of the reasons is the attitude of police officers. That attitude borders on paranoia and, in some case, belligerence. Police too frequently issue orders. If a police officer informs a person that they are under arrest, then the person is under arrest. Pretty simple. However, often a police officer will not inform a person that they are under arrest and then issues orders. Okay, so if a police officer doesn't tell you you're under arrest, but issues an order, all of a sudden, to compound the arrest that you're not informed of, you're going to be charged with resisting arrest under this new language? I don't think that's good. If a person does not know that they're under arrest because they haven't been told they're under arrest, how can they be charged with resisting arrest? The second reason why I have a problem with this particular language is that if there's someone who's observing an arrest with a camera or videotape and an officer says, you can't take pictures or videotapes of this particular arrest, and wants to seize the camera or the videotape or whatever, that person is, under this language, guilty of the crime of resisting arrest. And I think, you know, our form of government is one that seeks to preserve individual liberties by preventing tyranny of government. And to the extent that we as citizens have an obligation to prevent police brutality, you know, which means that you need to be able to observe the actions of a police, whether they want you to or not. That again is a reason why I think this language proposed, disobeying an office, an order of a police of a peace officer, is not good. So those are the two main reasons. And my final reason to speak against this is that it's a fiscal cost. I mean, where does it stop? Are we continually giving up our civil liberties and our freedoms as Americans to a police state? I mean, how many people need to go to prison so that everybody feels safe? The cost of incarceration is astronomical. I mean, to add to the charge of somebody, whatever they're arrested for initially, but to add to that the charge of resisting arrest, and then presumably adding to the time that they serve in prison, it costs money. And what have you really achieved? So those are the three reasons. And I thank you very much. And I hope that you will take this language out because it's not necessary. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Whitaker. Thanks for being here, and we appreciate your testimony. We've got online Mr. Ron Adler. Mr. Adler, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And you wanted to testify about SB 234.
Yes, I would.
Please proceed.
Hi, my name is Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ron Adler, and I'm the CEO/director of Alaska Psychiatric Institute, one of the more popular hospitals these days in the state of Alaska. And my remarks are short and to the point. While the Department of Health and Social Services supports the intent of this legislation, I'd like to point out to the committee that all sections relative to sending an incompetent to stand trial and presumably mentally ill defendant to API could cause capacity issues in the future. We're dealing with a quantity of a number of people that we don't have a handle on, and the forensic unit at API is typically full with a waiting list. So this could result in additional planning for changes in the facility or additional facilities in the state. And that concludes my testimony.
Just briefly, Mr. Adler, what is the forensic unit, and how much capacity do you have?
The forensic Mr. Chair, the forensic unit at API is called the TACU unit. It's a medium security unit. Although we have 10 beds, two are permanently occupied by NGRIs, and that stands for not guilty by reason of insanity. And the sentences, those are long-term sentences for people occupying those beds. So we really only have 8 beds to work with. And we do a lot of restoration to competency and culpability examinations inside the unit, as we have the only licensed forensic specialist in the state working here.
Thank you, Mr. Adler. I don't see any follow-up questions. We may have more for you as we consider the implications of some of the sections of the bill. Other questions for Mr. Adler? I don't hear or see any. With that, I'm going to we've got Steve West, who said he was signed to testify. Mr. West, is that true, or were you here to answer questions?
I can do some. I was here to testify, yes, sir.
Please, thank you. Go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear from you as well.
Right. I'm Steve West. I'm the district attorney in Ketchikan. I've worked here as either an assistant or as a district attorney for 22 years. What I'm talking about is the, sections 8, 9, 10 of the bill, dealing with the person who's found incompetent. The issue arose here with the defendant. His name's Marcus Anderson. All of this is is public record, so I'm not talking about anything that's really confidential. But in 2003, 2004, he committed 5 arsons here. He totaled, I think, 3 buildings were completely totaled. 2 of them were residences. and the other two buildings suffered minor damage. One of them was actually a room above a bar that had a bunch of people in it, and if the fire had started, gotten out of control, it could have caused a lot more damage than it was. The last fire he was charged with involved him, a witness who witnessed part of what happened with an earlier fire. Mr. Anderson went underneath his house. It was like at 3 in the morning. The guy just happened to be awake watching TV, and he heard some noise under his house. Looked out the window and saw Mr. Anderson walking away from his house, go down to the street, look up and look at the house, and then walk away. And the guy got suspicious, went down underneath his house, and there was it was open to the public out in the bottom part of it. And he had a wood pile under there, and there was a bunch of rope that had been stacked up there and some toilet paper, and it was all on fire. And he grabbed it and pulled it out with his bare hands, and so he burned his hands. So he didn't have a smoke alarm, and according to the fire investigator, if he hadn't been awake, the house would have caught fire and he would have been dead. Well, we charged him in 2004 for all of those arsons, and he talked with the fire investigators and admitted committing all of these fires. And he was found incompetent, and so I asked API to see, well, since the case is being dismissed because he's incompetent, why don't you see if we can commit him? They interviewed him and goes, well, he had, says he won't commit any more fires, so we can't commit him because he says he won't commit any more fires. Well, he got out, and within 6 months he's been charged with another arson that occurred in Saxman, another building. So, I mean, he's caused hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage here in Ketchikan for setting fires. He, according to his prior record, he's been setting fires since he was a teenager. The defense is now in the process of having him declared incompetent again. And if the judge finds his incompetent, he's been now found to be competent, but his defense has now brought another expert in to say he's incompetent. And so we're all back in again. All I see is the case getting dismissed and him being released out onto the public in town here. And I have absolutely no doubt what will happen. He'll commit another fire. He's done that numerous times over the years. And somebody's going to get killed as a result of it. What's interesting is one of the doctor who originally found him incompetent back in 2004 found that if the case went to trial, if he was competent and the case went to trial, he didn't have an insanity defense because he wasn't insane at the time. He knew what was going on, and he knew that what he was doing, and he knew what it was wrong, and therefore he doesn't have a insanity defense, but he just doesn't understand the court procedures, and therefore he's incompetent to stand trial. And even he admits that this individual is very dangerous, and he needs to be put in a 24-hour facility to be watched basically probably for the rest of his life because he's going to continue to set fires. And so what this bill will do is to correct that type of a problem where the individual gets out and continues to commit, in Mr. Anderson's case, serious arsons. And I have absolutely no doubt that one of these days he's going to set a fire and somebody's going to get killed or seriously injured. It was only a pure luck that the last fire in 2005, no one did get, or 2004, excuse me, the individual didn't get burned to death. He just happened to be awake at 3 or 4 in the morning watching the movie. If he hadn't been, he definitely would have been dead. So I do think that this bill would correct this issue. So I would support the passage of it.
Mr. West, thank you. Any questions for Mr. West? I don't see any. That takes care of the folks who are here to testify for the bill. We're going to go ahead and set it aside now and bring up SB 164. We do have one witness I wanted to hear from on that bill who's about to go into a trial next week for a long time. Let's have the representative of the sponsor come forward, give us a brief overview of what the bill does, and then we'll turn to Mr. Smith. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, and we'll be happy to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton, and I am staff for Senator Liesl McGuire. The senator sends her regards and her apologies for not being here. Unfortunately, there was a scheduling conflict. Mr. Chairman, the intent of Senate Bill 164 is to remove outdated language from Alaska statutes governing the sale of used motor vehicles. And we want to remove that language without in any way reducing consumer protections. The small subsection that Senate Bill 164 removes, while initially enrolled with good intentions, is now no longer of any benefit to dealers, consumers, or the state. Subsection C of Alaska Statute 4525-465 requires that all used vehicles for sale by a dealer have posted on the window three disclosures. One, the vehicle is not subject to Alaska's lemon laws. Two, the vehicle is not covered under a manufacturer's warranty. And three, the vehicle was not manufactured for sale in a foreign country. Now, these disclosures were mandated in response to an influx of Canadian vehicles that, while technically used, were being sold as new. And this was occurring, from my understanding, up until the early 2000s, up until just a few years ago. Since then, the market has corrected itself, and that practice that subsection C sought to address is no longer really an issue. And that came out of conversations with industry folk as well as individuals from the Department of Law. Furthermore, all three of the disclosures are information that's readily available to consumers as they go through the process of shopping for and buying a used vehicle. These mandated postings are now not only an inconvenience to those in the used vehicle business, but they may also be leaving dealers exposed to, I guess for lack of a better word, dubious lawsuits. Not posting the information outlined in subsection C amounts to an unfair trade practice. In violation of unfair trade practices allows for lawsuits that demand treble damages and reimbursement of full legal costs, even though consumers have not suffered any actual harm or damages. Mr. Chairman, while one might argue that you can never have too much consumer protection, when the state starts unnecessarily burdening Alaskan businesses while providing no additional consumer protection, the sponsor believes it's time to reevaluate. The sponsor reevaluated subsection C and found that it no longer provides the consumer protections it once did, and now merely poses unnecessarily requirements on auto dealers. And for these reasons, the sponsor and I urge you to support Senate Bill 164. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for the representative of the sponsor? I don't hear or see any. We do want to get to Mr. Sniffen, so thank you for being here today. Let's turn to Ed Sniffen from the Department of Law. Mr. Sniffen, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks for holding on so long. Please tell us your view and tell us who you are and then your view of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in Anchorage, and I am responsible for enforcing Alaska's Consumer Protection Act and antitrust statutes, with a particular emphasis on regulating Alaska's auto dealers, and which I have a good ongoing, I think, working relationship with. And although we don't necessarily agree on everything, I think we have worked closely together to address some of the problems that have plagued Alaska consumers when it comes to buying and selling motor vehicles. And I agree with everything Trevor had to say about this bill. I think he accurately described how this legislation came about. In our letter to the sponsor of the bill, I do want to point one thing out, and that is we made some comments in our letter that we didn't understand how the statute at the time was passed with reference to a disclosure requirement that extended to all used vehicles as opposed to just current model used vehicles. And we have since had communications with Representative Max Gruenberg, who indicates that he did remember adding that language specifically because he wanted to extend those protections to all used cars. So we will be speaking with the representative about his concerns to make sure that they are addressed. But even so, I think Trevor identified the issues very well in that the protections provided by this section are already required in a number of other ways. And with the removal of the current model vehicle language from Title 8 a couple of years ago, it created an issue for us with this statute that we were trying to address, because current model vehicle is kind of an odd concept. It's a difficult one to define. And the industry has pretty much corrected itself in the sense that the harms caused by selling current model vehicles without the disclosures that this statute addresses have been removed. So I'm happy to answer any questions if the committee would like more specific details on that. I know it's getting late in the day here, but nonetheless, if you'd like me to go into those details, I'm happy to. Otherwise, that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sniffen. I've got a couple questions. There's in the bill packet, there's a piece of paper that on page 2 of my bill packet that's got a little, it looks like a little sticker. We'll refer to that to the little sticker. On the next page on page 3, there's a big sticker. And the sticker we're affecting, if you will, is the little sticker. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The disclosures that are currently required under federal law are probably, I don't have your packet, but I assume it's the big sticker. It would be the one that says, you know, as is, and has some boxes on there for the dealer to check.
Right. It says says warranty or no warranty with yes. A buyer's guide at the top.
Exactly. That is correct. And the little stick would be the sticker that this bill would not require a dealer to post.
Now, the little sticker tells you three things. One, this car is being sold not subject to the lemon laws. Two, it's not being sold with a warranty. And three, it's not not built in Canada. Now, it looks like the big sticker is pretty clear about the as-is, no warranty versus warranty. I mean, a person couldn't miss that. And what about the warning or the notice, if you will, that this car wasn't built in Canada? What part of the big sticker tells a consumer that?
Through the chair, there is no part of the big sticker that I'm aware of that requires that, but that requirement would not change. Auto dealers would still have to post a requirement on the car if the vehicle was manufactured for sale in Canada or another foreign country. And that comes from another statute. It's 4525-470. So there's some duplicate requirements there. And by removing that from 4525-465, the dealer would still have to put a sticker on a car if, in fact, that car was manufactured for sale in Canada or another foreign country.
Okay, so I guess that just leaves the, so you're saying 470 would still require a Canadian sticker, we'll just call it that, and there's all, you're saying, and so that leaves the lemon law. What portion of the big sticker tells a consumer you're buying a car that doesn't have the Alaska statute's lemon law protections?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question, and it's a little trickier in this sense because the lemon law protections are in fact warranty protections that apply only to new cars. So by receiving the big sticker, the as-is sticker, that there is no warranty on the car, you are telling the consumer that the lemon law would not apply to this car, although you do it not in quite so clear a terms. But as far as I know, there is no state that has a requirement that consumers be told you're buying a used car, and you know whether the state's lemon law applies or doesn't apply. Some states do actually have used car lemon law statutes, but I'm not aware of any state that requires that kind of disclosure because it is a warranty type of disclosure that the bigger sticker sort of subsumes in its content. But you are correct. There would not be that specific disclosure that Alaska's lemon law doesn't apply to this purchase of a vehicle.
And as a consumer protection guy, you're comfortable with that?
Through the chair, yes, I am. And I'm comfortable with it only in the sense that it's fairly common knowledge, I think. I don't know that that's the kind of information consumers really rely upon when they, buy a car, don't buy a car. For new vehicles, the lemon law has a very specific application, and there's a reason for it, and consumers are told that, in fact, when they do buy a new vehicle, you've got these rights, and manufacturers are actually required to include that in the owner's manual for all new cars. When it comes to used cars, that bit of information is just not, it's not that harmful to consumers to not have, because it wouldn't apply anyway, so I'm not certain that a lot of consumers rely on that when they go out and they buy used cars.
And last question for me is, the bill is retroactive. Why is that?
Through the chair, another excellent question, and we talked about this a little bit in the last committee, and it's retroactive because it was our understanding that at the time it was passed, it wasn't meant to apply to all used car sales other than this small universe of current model used cars. So I think there are some dealers out there who thought that was the correct application of the law, and they did not make those kinds of disclosures. And once they've realized that, oh my gosh, I have to put this disclosure on every used car, I think they started doing it, but there was a period of time in there before that information really got around, and that I think that exposes a lot of the dealers, and the dealers will, if there's someone online from the Dealers Association, can talk about this a little more, who in good faith have attempted to comply with the law, but now are exposed to, you know, significant liability for failure to do that. And what this law would do is, if there isn't already a, you know, a pending claim against those dealers, it would help protect those dealers who have complied with the law and don't have any complaints against them for not making these kinds of disclosures.
And has the state of Alaska brought any actions to enforce this law as it stood?
Yes, through the chair, we have brought an action. There is a pending action right now in Alaska Supreme Court on appeal from a case that we brought against Lithia dealerships. Our case against the Lithia dealerships centered on some other issues, but as part of our settlement, we recognized that they failed to make, you know, some of these other disclosures as well, and have asked for injunctive relief against Lithia from going forward. They need to make these disclosures until there is a time when the law is either changed or it's no longer necessary.
Does the state, I mean, obviously you're suggesting we have a retroactive clause, so I guess the answer to the question is, does the state envision any further actions? Your answer would be no against other dealerships.
Through the chair, that is correct. And the reason for that is simply because, and even in the current case we have against Lithia, we assigned very little consumer harm to the failure to make these disclosures. We weren't able to identify any transactions where consumers would have said, well, hey, if I had known this information, I would not have engaged in this transaction or purchased this vehicle. If we do come across information that suggests that had these disclosures been made and a consumer would have relied on those disclosures in making these purchasing decisions, we would consider taking action, you know, even now under the statute. If it's retroactively applied and we don't have something pending, I still think we would have good grounds to proceed, because all of these things are probably required by something else. And one of the provisions that can cause the most harm is the failure to disclose that the vehicle is manufactured for sale in Canada or a foreign country, because the warranty issues can be affected by that. I think most of the major manufacturers have addressed that problem, but for a time, if a car was made for sale in Canada and you brought it to Alaska, it automatically voided the manufacturer's warranty. And if consumers had known that information, they certainly wouldn't have purchased some of these vehicles. And we have seen some of those complaints and have addressed those problems. Now, though, going forward, I know most of the manufacturers have addressed that problem. They do extend warranty coverage for those vehicles, and so we don't see as many of them now. But that requirement is already required and will continue to be required.
That's all the questions I have, Mr. Sniffen. Any other questions from members of the committee? Don't hear or see any. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
We have one other person who wants to testify about this bill, and that's Mr. John Cook. Mr. Cook, are you on the line?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Cook. I'm the legislative director of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. Just to follow up on a couple of things, I think Trevor and Mr. Sniffen have made excellent points, I guess, in giving us some history and kind of some of the unintended consequences that have come out of this legislation that was passed back in 2004. I guess I'd just like to do a few things, which is, one, reiterate that all of the disclosures required in that second sticker are either unnecessary or redundant. You know, again, with regard to discussing the Lemon Law, you know, first off, it applies only to new vehicles. So, you know, to put kind of what I would call a negative disclosure on there, to me seems, to me seems unnecessary. You know, the warranty disclosure is covered in the FTC sticker, which every used vehicle in the United States is required to display. Thirdly, again, as Mr. Sniffen discussed, 4525-470 requires that all Canadian vehicles made for Canadian manufacture have that disclosed. I guess a couple of the things I'd like to touch on, and one of which you brought up is the, you know, the retroactivity and the reasoning behind that, and the language that we agreed upon. You know, in discussing retroactivity, Mr. Sniffen is correct that most of us that were used car dealers had, you know, that sold used cars had no idea when that legislation finally passed out that it contained a requirement that second sticker be added to all used cars. There were five different versions of that bill that came out. I was not legislative director at the time, but there were five versions that came out, and frankly, how that got through without either Mr. Sniffen or our group, you know, realizing that, you know, that language had been changed. I don't know how it happened, but that's what happened. You know, the fallout from this is that none of us were aware that this second sticker had to be, or I would say very few of us were aware that this second sticker had to be displayed until a lawsuit was filed, in particular the one Mr. Sniffen is mentioning, where we have litigation risk for all of the dealers in the state of Alaska is that because this is an unfair trade practice, there's a two-year look-back period. And that two-year look-back period leaves dealerships exposed. And it leaves them exposed for a statutory requirement that, frankly, none of us were aware of, and that provided no tangible benefits to the, you know, the dealers, the consumers, or the state of Alaska. So that is the reasoning for the, you know, the retroactivity that's in there. You know, we believe that the language has been left broad enough to let any cases that are out there, and we only know of one company that's being sued, but, you know, saying that it would be to the extent allowed by law, we'll leave it up to the courts to figure out, you know, what needs to happen. But, you know, I can tell you that we're aware of this same firm, you know, fishing for other potential suits right now. And, you know, to us, it seems quite unfair. You know, if these suits were to go forward, a company like Lithia that's publicly traded, quite frankly, can probably withstand the blows of a class action suit. But the majority of our membership, which is which are family-owned, locally owned businesses, would have a real hard time standing up against a protracted class action suit for, you know, something of this nature. That's all I have to say at this point. I appreciate Mr. Sniffen's testimony. I can tell you that we certainly do not always agree on every issue, but we respect each other and have a great working relationship. And typically when the two, our side and his side, come together on these things and we hammer out you know, something that we think is fair for both parties, it generally ends up being a good thing. So again, I appreciate his efforts, and I'm available for questions if you have any.
Mr. Cook, I think I'll let the committee hang on to those questions, sir, for a future hearing. The bill is going to be held for the time being. We'll have it back up for a hearing before too long. I appreciate your willingness to stay late in the day. I appreciate the committee members' willingness to stay late in the day. It's 10 minutes after 3. With that, we're going to be adjourned.